I guess we're here. And welcome to Freightonomics. I'm Zach Strickland, head of Freight Market Intelligence. With me, Tony Mulvey. And we are going to, we got a lot of stuff going on this week. It's kind of a mix and match.
Yeah, it's been a busy week from a news perspective, a macro perspective, there's freight so perspective.
Yeah, like we're really going to do a whole mix and match episode here today. We've got, you know, a lot of the government influence and things. We've got a couple of rulings or, you know, potential rulings going on that have a pretty dramatic potential impact on the overall industry.
For freight. Mm-hmm. Other industries too, but freight, I know we talk about it all the time. We hear about it all the time. It's very, going to be impactful. It's to some degree.
Yeah.
Just a matter of when.
Yeah. And obviously it's not just transportation. We'll talk about it in the context of transportation primarily, but we have the GDP early figure in that we have to go through. And I want to talk a little bit about yield curve.
Oh boy.
Like, and I know this gets thrown around a lot and people, I think, you know, especially in finance, kind of use this as like a crutch index to people that don't know or maybe don't want to read all about the economics and recessions and things like that. I want to at least clear up some of the haze around the understanding there for people that aren't familiar with the yield curve. It is the Treasury bill. Long-term rates relating to the short-term rates. Typically, long-term rates are higher than short-term rates. That has not been the case for a couple of years now.
it hasn't. Yeah. And I mean, that's the key takeaway is it basically just says the short term in this situation, the short term outlook is a little more hazy than the long term outlook.
But I'm going to dispel a little bit of that. So
see it.
First things first, though, we always talk about the freight market.
Yep. And let's see what's happening in the freight market with your market in two. So Zach, I'll count you in. So in three, two, one.
Oh, man. And the chart comes in hot. Outbound tender rejection index. Guess what? Not a lot of change here. We are trending higher, though. You can barely, if you really kind of squint and look down, we're trending higher over the last month or so, month and a half-ish. Rejection rates up, getting, you know, we were around 4% last week. We kind of come back down a little bit, but now it's trend lines. This is sort of what I would expect this year. We're seeing capacity slowly bleed out. Contract rates are coming down. That's going to marginally increase these rejection rates. What is the thing to watch for is any sharp movements, especially at a regional level. I think that's where we're going to see it first. We're going to see some small pockets start to percolate, and then we're going to see the larger market itself capitulate a little bit. Let's break this down a little further in our next chart with the flatbed tender rejection index, as well as the refrigerated and van down there on the lower end. Flatbed rejections do not account for a lot of this index, or flatbed tenders, I should say. Less than 5% of the overall tender data, I believe, at this point, is flatbed volume. Actually, it might be closer to 10 nowadays. I'll check that. But flatbed rejection rates on their way up. It's the only one. Refrigerated, still moving inward and closer to the van rejection rates. Somewhat surprising this time of year. We normally see the refrigerated sector start to percolate. Let's move to the next one. The flatbed truckload index, along with the refrigerated and NTI spot rates, aggregated spot rates for flat, refrigerated in blue, and NTI for dry van there in yellow. Not a lot to see for NTI. Dry van is flat lining, as you see, not a lot of change. I think the takeaway there is that they're not dropping lower. Refrigerated, however, have been trending lower since January. Had a little bit of a spike there at the end of March, but not so much anymore. Flatbed on its way up. Takeaway, flatbed sector is still the sector to watch. We are in the spring seasonal period where things get to percolate a little bit more there.
Yeah, and we talked about it last week, housing starts, right? They were down, but it's not a cause for concern, especially with you look at flatbed rejections and flatbed spot rates. Like those two tend to correlate fairly well with housing starts. That's why that 1 month figure is not a ring the alarm, like set off any bells and whistles, sirens, or anything like that. Like, see what happens in April, because it may turn out that it was just a 1 month blip on the radar, and then it comes back a little stronger. And I mean, I think the reefer one's probably the reefer market, probably the most interesting from a timing perspective of the where we're at in this should be the earlier stages of produce season, kind of things starting to move a little further north out of, you know, southern Florida and getting into central and like that upper stage of southern Georgia mm-hmm. come what? I mean, May's in a few days, right? So that perspective, I mean, well, you would like to see a little more activity.
Mother's Day's right around the corner.
Yeah.
And that tends to be where we first start to see some decent activity in other parts of in Florida for sure. California, nothing really moving that significantly there. Florida, we had strawberries already. They were pretty good, decent volume, but still it's Florida and they've got plenty of trucks. I think the refrigerated sector being as down as it is after having a good fourth quarter last year and a decent start to the year is the most surprising aspect of this, is that it looks like that space, all it's going to take is a gust of wind to move it higher. So I'm still in a bullish scenario for the RTI because this downturn,
it's surprising. I mean, it just sets up the upside to be that much more extreme.
Like a trampoline.
Yeah.
You know, the harder you fall, the harder you potentially, you know, propel yourself. The refrigerated sector is certainly one that I'm not sleeping on moving forward, especially as temperatures warm up.
Yeah, exactly.
Economics. Let's talk about a little economics here. The overall, you know, we had a GDP release. Let's hit that one first, Tony. Yeah. GDP 1.6%.
well under expectations. I mean, expectations are 2.4. So, I mean, you're talking almost a full percentage point. It's showing. So, GDP growth peaked in the third quarter of 2023, and it has since slowed. Guess what? The Fed raised interest rates until the third quarter, and then they paused, and now you're seeing the effects of what raising interest rates does. It slows the economy down, and it's happening. And I think what's interesting about the whole GDP release is, one, you start looking in consumer spending starting to slow, but it was more spending on services that boosted or created this year-over-year growth versus spending in goods, which is interesting when you look at freight demand. Mm-hmm. To me, this highlights kind of why we may have seen freight demand strong relative to where it was a year ago. Inventory levels. Yep. I would think that is the driver, because you see it in imports.
Exactly.
We're up, but it's not necessarily that consumers are spending. It's other things that are having this impact. And then you start to look at other factors. Saving rates from a consumer perspective are lower. Your GDP is being boosted largely from investments at local and state governments. It's underwhelming. But I think what it does, while inflation is still high and the quarterly PCE number was up from where it was the previous quarter, we will see tomorrow where March comes in. Mm-hmm. But to me, it signals, hey, interest rate cuts are on the maybe back on the table in an aggressive way. I say aggressive, meaning three, just because you've got to. I mean, again, what was the goal with the Fed? Curb inflation, keep unemployment high. But I mean, it
unemployment low,
maximum employment. Sorry, but I mean, the idea being that the economy is clearly slowing, and there's going to need to be some boost of economic activity one way. And the problem is, if you start doing that, inflation's still a problem. And it's clearly still a problem, and it doesn't go away when you start cutting.
Yeah, and I think it's because our understanding of inflation has changed, or it should change. It hasn't changed. We're treating inflation like we have historically as this really ultimate evil. Yeah. And that's the Fed's kind of their direction. That's what they were given. Guess what? The world's different. I want to pull up a chart for the PCE. And the CPI, not that one that they have pulled up. It's down a little bit further in my sheet that I gave you guys. There we go. That's the one. So when we hear about PCE, that's the one that the Fed prefers. Now, this is a little noisy chart, but the key lines that I want you to look at here are the blue one that have that mountain peak at the very end, 2022. And then there's a little bit of a red line underneath that. That is the CPI in blue and the PCE in red. So you can see the correlation is super strong, but the CPI tends to move a little bit higher over time than the PCE. And that's you know, it's the PCE is generally considered more encompassing. It doesn't just include urban spending and things like that. The other one, the CPI, tends to include some pretty decent inflationary signals because of the nature of data around these urban centers. And so if we look at the PCE, it's actually moving lower. CPI is staying a little stickier over time. But this, the understanding here, we've come out of a period of time where we had inflated demand relative to supply for many, many goods.
Yeah.
Corporations are incentivized to charge for that. Yeah. And they are going to pass along those costs. And their boards, their investors, what do they say to everybody? We have to increase shareholder value.
Yeah.
That is the primary driving force behind this, because consumers haven't really slowed their spending.
They haven't changed it in a way that's material enough for them to feel it to make any changes themselves.
Exactly. And so until that goes away and people are just spending more money, they're putting it on their credit cards, the debt levels are up, the Fed interest rates aren't having the impact on consumption that they traditionally used to have.
Yeah, it's a different environment. And that's I think that's the biggest problem. I don't even say problem, but I guess it is to some degree, is that the Fed looks at historical figures and looks back in history to try to make policies, as opposed to looking at what's happening now. Like where, like they're trying to go back to a date to try to match a date in the past, as opposed to be forward thinking, like what is going to happen? Like what are the impacts we're going to face?
Right.
And that's the challenge that they face. And they don't succeed in it very often, it doesn't feel like, because but to their credit, they only have one lever that they can pull in either direction, right? They can only cut or raise interest rates.
I get it.
And, or the Fed funds rate, not even interest rates. Interest rates are based off that,
you know, and it really isn't proven that what they're doing has any impact on inflation at all.
Yeah.
And that's the scary part. You know, Paul Volcker back in the 80s got away with it, but other forces were at play.
Yeah.
At that time. And this is the part where it's almost like, are you doing this for show or is this actually having an impact?
Yep.
So I want to move forward into the T-bill, because this all comes together here in a minute. I'm going to tie this all into a nice little bow. So inflation still kind of higher than people want it to be, the Fed specifically. The T-bill, 10-year, this is what our mortgage rates are based on. This is what a lot of long-term debt is based on, is this 10-year treasury bill. This is what the Fed sells off debt so they can fund their operations. And then over time, if the rates go up for the 10-year, that means there's demand increasing over supply. So people want more 10-year treasuries. There's a little bit more risk involved in the longer term debt. Therefore, typically, they get more money for investing in the longer term debt.
Yeah.
The shorter term debt doesn't have as big of a interest rate or a payout for it, percentage-wise. So what you're looking at here is the opposite of that. This is the 10-year less the 2-year T-bill. It should be, that black line right there means that the 10-year is higher than the 2-year. Everything below that is where the 10-year is below, is paying out less than the 2-year. So what people expect to happen, and this is the last 10 years, mind you, look at this trend line, Tony. You don't know anything about what I just said.
Yeah.
And you don't care. Look at the direction of this curve. This is the, you know, a version of the yield curve, if you will. Look at how, like, the trend of this before anything, regardless of recessionary behavior, because the whole idea is that when the yield curve is inverted, everything below that black line there, there's a recession about to happen.
Yeah.
This looks to be fundamentally flawed in the fact that, guess what? People are just trying to, you know, they're actually just short-term centric.
They are.
They're becoming more short-term centric.
Yeah, it's uncertainty, right? They basically, they're feeling, they think the longer term is kind of less risky, right? They're being more risk averse. It's interesting though, because like, to me, I look at it in comparison to like the stock market, right? Because you have to measure it against like what is risk-free the idea being the treasury bill is relatively risk-free. Your yield on it is what you're going to earn versus the stock market. So you weigh those two. to me, it shows that there's just uncertainty and like where the economy kind of is. And that's what I think the inversion is so important and why it tends to flag recessions in historical preference.
Yeah, probably one of the most stable economic growth periods in history from the post the Great Recession, which is where this chart largely
starts
yeah, to now. And it's almost like, you know, if you're in finance, guess what? This just means that they're buying more of these T-bills in a shorter term
yeah,
for whatever function they're trying to perform.
Yep.
They are trying to so there's higher demand for short-term debt than there is for long-term.
Yep.
And this is because there's more transactions, there's more movement, there's more activity if you are in that space. So don't listen to people when they say the inverted yield curve predicts a recession. Guess what? This thing's been inverted for a year and a half almost.
And we're not in it.
We're not in a recession.
Yeah.
So that no longer holds water. Like, and a lot of economists have said this for years, that this isn't actually a predictor.
Well, the problem is it's such a liquid market now that it can change very rapidly. And that's where it probably was a better indicator prior when it wasn't as liquid. I mean, now it's so easy to get in and out that it can cause these inversions. And again, it's largely sentiment driven, right?
It's totally sentiment driven. So it doesn't really mean anything anymore. It is a thing to watch though, because, if you're trying to buy a house, you want that 10-year debt to be low.
Yeah.
So you don't have to. It's right around 4.6% right now, which is well above the coupon rate of 4%, where it was issued. But that being said, let's move forward into the newsonomics because, you know, I just wanted to dispel a little bit of that inverted yield curve talk because I hear about it a lot and it's not understood very well in general.
Yeah, it is a complex.
Yeah, it's very complex if you're not in finance and things like that. So I'm going to do a little rapid fire with you, Tony, because we got a lot of stuff going on. First story, Panama Canal's future is dark and stormy, much to shippers' relief. This is good news, right?
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's an interesting dynamic. And I mean, the Panama Canal is one of those things. It's like you need, I mean, yes, because idea dark, the stormy, right? You need, I can't, I'll give credit to Michael Rudolph for this one because I...
Well done on the title.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean...
Rain means boats get to flow freely through the Panama Canal.
Correct.
Therefore, we are...
You have more options, right?
More options. Rates should continue to...
And they are. Pressure. And you look at... I mean, you look at ocean spot rates. Mm-hmm. They're declining across the board. The risk of the Red Sea is kind of largely pat. Like, these outside influencers are not... They're proving the market's not being able to sustain these outside.
This is a huge hang-up for a lot of people in importing stuff into the United States. Mm-hmm. Looks like that's going to have some relief. They still expect third, fourth quarter to be where it's actually back to.
Yeah, I mean you're still in the. Yeah, I mean you're still in the quote dry season for, I mean a few more weeks. Yeah. So
next up, Heartland Express books another net loss. Heartland traditionally a company that operates exquisitely.
Yeah.
This integration issue with their acquisitions, I've been involved in certain things like this over my history and tenure where you buy a company and you don't realize they have a pricing problem.
Yep.
They had some bad business on their books, apparently. I think that's what this is telling me. I don't know that. And, you know, it just looks that way because I've had experience in that space before where you do buy another carrier and operator and you get to inherit their problems.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a reason that they were willing to sell.
Yeah, you don't sell if you're making money hand over fist, right?
Like
you're, to me, when I look at this, and Heartland's credit before, right? I mean, they had made acquisition. They had been acquisitive and been in that market and made it work for quite some time. And it's, I think this is more just proving that it was, one, it was bigger than most acquisitions that they made when you look at CFI.
Yeah, way bigger.
So
yeah.
It's bigger. So it's going to take more time to clean up the operation.
It takes about 2 years to clean up some of these.
And you're getting close to that 2 year mark, really. Yeah. So you're
They're also having to navigate this in a down market.
Which is the time, if you're going to buy it, I mean, this is the time you want to do it. Or
they bought it in 2022.
Yeah. So they probably. Either way, I mean, you were still in a market that was starting to show like fundamental cracks. Yeah. But at the end of the day, it's going to be set up for a way to take advantage of the upswing if they can, it's just bearing this bad news right now.
They
have to make improvements, but it's also a setup that should be beneficial come, you know, the market change.
Yeah. Knight Swift focuses on cost reductions, asset utilization. Nothing new here. We talked about this last week. I don't get a good sense. I don't have a good vibe here with Dave Jackson, Dave Jackson's departure, the longtime CEO there. There's something just doesn't feel good to me here. I don't have any real good data around it, but there's something concerning about dropping from an 86 to a 97 OR. I know they bought US Express.
That's
probably part of it. Intermodal is actually a legitimate concern, dropping from a 95 to a 105.
Yeah, because that's not buying an operator.
But that is a pricing problem, because if you looked at their drop-off, their revenue per load's down 20%. Their load count's only down 1.6%.
Yeah.
That's a pricing issue. The truckload side of things, I think there's some endemic stuff going on there that they need to get their hands around. Maybe it has something to do with acquisition, just like Heartland.
Yeah. I mean, I think it does. Mm-hmm. I look at revenue per loaded mile down 10%. It's not, all things considered, it's not that bad. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's pretty much in line with where the market is. You look at mile deadhead percentage down slightly. I mean, the OR is interesting, but again, it's how much of that is US Express driven. I think it's a pretty substantial thing. They said they're making progress to it to be break even. So think 100 OR. So it tells me that it was above 100 OR again. Mm-hmm. That's more of that. It's just going to take time.
Yep.
But the intermodal side is a concern, but they've also diversified into LTL. Mm-hmm. And LTL doesn't necessarily face the same pricing problems pricing pressures that intermodal especially
no, not
facing
at all. We've talked
or about truckload even. Yeah. So like
look
the pricing.
Dominion.
Yeah. I mean,
they did just fine. And of course the investors didn't think so. That's a story for another day. The last couple of things here on the regulations, FMCSA standing up registration fraud team. This is kind of like a thank you for doing your job finally.
They've been asleep at the wheel and now they're waking up to the actual issue.
They're just now implementing like multi-factor things for the MC numbers so people can, there's a little bit of, you know, validation going on in the back end for people that are registering for motor carrier numbers. Should have already been happening. And then we had Kendra, CEO of Truck Stop, Kendra Tucker and Craig talking about this. Double brokering and, you know, really fighting against load board fraud, which involves double brokering and is related to the MC number. You know, people are selling MC numbers and they don't realize that, hey, people are using your identity as well as shell companies so that they can offer freight to other people and never pay them. And that's double brokering's misuse. There is actually a more innocuous double brokering clause. Or use where people will just hand off, if you're overbooked as a carrier and then you hand it off to another one to haul it, you know, that's okay in theory, but what happens most of the time is they're not as safe. There's some safety issues. And then you get into the situation where it's a fraudulent company.
Yeah. It's about time. I mean, that's the key takeaway. It's one of those, it's needed to happen. It's finally happening. Thank you for waking up, government, because, you know, it always seems they're late to the party. Guess what? Private businesses are more efficient at fighting things than government is. And I think that is it's not just in freight, it's across.
Well, if you're going to warehouse the official registrations, you need to have a basic like guideline around how that happens.
Yep.
Like you have to safeguard that.
Yeah.
If you're going to be the source of truth, you need to make sure that you're actually making it the source of truth.
Yes.
And not something that's misused easily as it has been. And thank goodness they're finally doing that. The last thing I think we need to tell people to watch is the Chamber of Commerce sues the FTC for banning non-compete clauses. Non-compete, a huge thing, and not just in transportation, but in the world, but traditionally in brokerages. If you go into a brokerage, they tell you you can't compete, you can't take your business with you when you leave. if this happens, this could dramatically influence the brokerage industry.
Yep, it could, but it's not going to be instant. It's not overnight. There's regulations about, is the rule, well, Chamber of Commerce suing them, saying, is this even legal, is the first hurdle to kind of get over. And then there's a time frame post that. But Zach, future supply chains coming up. We've got two shows. We're going to be live in Atlanta twice doing Freightonomics. If you haven't gotten your ticket, go ahead and get your ticket. Use that Freightonomics code, Freightonomics FSC24, and get that code. And we will see y'all next week.
Yeah, and I'm debating Ken Adamo there. So.